Good afternoon and welcome to our last afternoon panel on the spending clause after the health care decision. As the final panel of the day, this should serve, I think, as a good bookend with the first panel this morning on federalism and federal power, where there was some discussion also of the spending clause. This is an outstanding panel, and I thank the Federalist Society for putting together such a good panel of experts on this topic, and I think you will benefit from their discussion. Let me introduce our panelists. We'll hear from each of them for something, I hope, in around 10 minutes each, and then each will have about a five-minute either rebuttal or follow-up, and then we hope to save time at the end for any questions that you might have. We're going to begin with Lee Casey, partner in the law firm of Baker and Hostetler. From 1986 to 1983, he served in various capacities in the federal government, including the Office of Legal Counsel and the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice. He was part of the legal team representing the 26 states challenging the Affordable Care Act at the trial and appellate levels. He has his undergraduate degree from Oakland University in Michigan and his law degree from the University of Michigan. Next, we'll hear from John Eastman, professor of law at Chapman University School of Law, undergraduate degree, University of Dallas, Chicago Law School, and PhD from Claremont. He's the founding director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which is a public interest law firm. He's the chairman of the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. Before joining the faculty at Chapman, Dr. Eastman served as a law clerk to Clarence Thomas and to Fourth Circuit Judge Michael Ludig, and practiced law with Kirkland and Ellis. Next, we'll hear from Edward Rubin, who's University Professor of Law and Political Science at Vanderbilt. Received his BA from Princeton, a master's in education from City College of New York, and a JD from Yale. After clerking on the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit for Judge John Newman, and practicing entertainment law in New York, he joined the law faculty at the University of California, Berkeley, in 1982, where he served as associate dean for 2 years, then moved to the University of Pennsylvania Law School and became dean at Vanderbilt in 2005. And finally, Robert Gassaway, a partner in the DC office of Kirkland and Ellis, received his undergraduate degree at Northwestern, University of Chicago Law School. He's a trial and appellate advocate with experience litigating cases before the United States Supreme Court, the DC Circuit, and other federal and state appellate courts. He has experience in environmental, administrative, and regulatory law, and in constitutional law trial and appellate work, with a focus on litigation and counseling in high exposure cases. That will begin with Lee Casey.
Thank you, Judge. The spending clause after the Obamacare decision. I will probably take the bright side of this issue, perhaps in contrast to some of my colleagues. I do think that the Medicaid portion of the NFIB decision may over time prove to be the most important aspect of that case. NFIB represents, of course, the first time that the Supreme Court has actually applied limits to the spending power based upon the coercive nature of federal grant conditions. The court suggested such limits in Stewart Machine Company versus Davis and South Dakota, of course, versus Dole, but as the 11th Circuit pointed out below in our case, our review of the relevant case law indicates that no court has ever struck down a law such as this one as unduly coercive. Yes, the court was right about that. No court ever had. Now, however, seven justices have found that the ACA's Medicaid expansion provisions were impermissibly coercive, although, as you know, the remedies that various justices adopted differed. The ACA's Medicaid expansion provisions were, of course, a central part of Congress's effort to achieve near universal health care coverage. Before the ACA, Medicaid was a joint federal-state program designed to provide health care to certain discrete categories of individuals, such as pregnant women and families with dependent children, with incomes below the federal poverty line. The ACA transforms this program into one of the principal pillars of national health care coverage, requiring that states extend a prescribed package of Medicaid benefits to everyone with incomes up to 133%, now actually 138% of the federal poverty line. As a result, an estimated 17 million new participants will join the Medicaid program by 2021, and this expansion will, of course, involve staggering new spending levels. Although the federal government will pay 100% of the additional costs associated with this expansion between 2014 and 2016, the federal share will be reduced to 90% by 2020. And of course, these federal contributions are entirely dependent upon continued congressional appropriations for these purposes. States that choose not to participate in the ACA's Medicaid expansion as originally enacted face the loss, not merely of the new funding, but of all their Medicaid dollars. As Chief Justice Roberts noted in his opinion, Medicaid spending accounts for over 20% of the average state's total budget, with federal funds covering 50 to 83% of those costs. The issue was, of course, enormously important to the states in their challenge to Obamacare. And it's important to note that it wasn't just the amounts involved, but also the manner in which Medicaid dollars are integrated into most state health delivery systems. A state that did withdraw from Medicaid, with perhaps one or two exceptions, would have had little realistic prospect of replacing those funds from its own tax base, as noted indeed by the joint dissenters, and would have faced the very real prospect of watching its health care delivery system collapse as institutions dependent on Medicaid payments lost that revenue stream. Nevertheless, both the District Court and the Court of Appeals upheld the ACA's Medicaid expansion provisions, reasoning that the states did, at least as a matter of law, have a choice, however difficult that choice might be. It also is clear that the lack of any precedent striking down a federal spending program as coercive in this manner informed the court's analysis, both at the trial and appellate level. It is certainly not too much to say that this case finally called the question, did Steward, Machine, and Dole stand for the proposition that there was some limit, a line Congress could not cross in the federal revenue sharing context, because if ever there was a case of coercion, it was this one. The Supreme Court said yes. There is such a line, and it is, in this case, at least we will enforce it, at least notionally. Although the Medicaid program itself is voluntary, conditioning potentially all of a state's Medicaid funding on its implementation of the ACA's program revisions is coercive and exceeds Congress's legitimate authority under the spending clause. Both Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justices Breyer and Kagan, and the joint dissenters agree on this point. The threatened loss of funding was not merely an inducement offered to the states for compliance, but as the chief aptly put it, a gun to the head. It was therefore constitutionally impermissible. The question for us, of course, is how to apply this ruling in the future. Is this a unique case because Medicaid is unique? And it is. Will the court simply know coercion when it sees it? Or is there some discernible legal rule that can be applied in other cases? I don't think the answer to this question, to be honest, is entirely clear, but I think perhaps, yes. Seven justices agreed that the ACA was impermissibly coercive in this instance, although they approached the question somewhat differently. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Breyer and Kagan emphasized the very significant amounts at stake in Medicaid, but also the quasi-contractual nature of such federal grants. Of course, it has long been established that if Congress wishes to attach conditions to federal money, it must do so unambiguously, as the court held in the Pennhurst case, so that the states are able to make an informed decision at the outset. Here, the chief reasoned, although various changes to and expansions in the original Medicaid program could have been anticipated, the states could not have anticipated the wholesale revision of the program covering discrete populations to a general health care package for a significant portion of the population. This, he concluded, accomplishes a shift in kind, not merely of degree. It is no longer a program to care for the neediest among us, but rather an element of a comprehensive national plan to provide universal health care coverage. I think it is significant that this portion of the judge's opinion relies on a point argued by actually a colleague of Professor Rubin at Vanderbilt University, Professor Jim Blumstein, in a very fine amicus brief that he filed in the case. He analogized the Medicaid program to a long-term relational contract and distinguished sharply between contract formation, at which point Congress, of course, would have maximum flexibility, and contract modification, where it would not have quite so much flexibility. Obviously, Congress can't eliminate a federal program, since however painful that might be for the states, Congress at least would leave them where it found them. What Congress cannot do is leverage a state's participation in the existing program as a means of forcing it to accept fundamental changes in that program, changes that the states could not have anticipated when they originally agreed to participate, that would indeed increase the financial and administrative burdens. Professor Blumstein called this predatory leveraging, and I think that sums it up perfectly. The joint dissent did not adopt the language of contract, but their analysis was very much focused on whether Congress was impermissibly leveraging state Medicaid participation to force states into the new program as well. Certainly, they also emphasized the staggering amounts at issue here and correctly noted that the offer that the ACA makes to the states to go along with the dramatic expansion of Medicaid or potentially lose all Medicaid funding is quite unlike anything that has been seen in a prior spending case. But I think congressional purpose mattered more. As they wrote, whether federal spending legislation crosses the line from enticement to coercion is often difficult to determine, and courts should not conclude that legislation is unconstitutional on this ground unless the coercive nature of an offer is unmistakably clear. In this case, however, there can be no doubt in structuring the ACA, Congress unambiguously signaled its belief that every state would have no real choice but to go along with the Medicaid expansion. Here, the joint dissenters cited the ACA's goal of near universal coverage and the Medicaid expansion's critical role in achieving that result. No other provision, they correctly pointed out, was enacted to cover the cohorts that would otherwise have fulfilled their mandate obligations through the new Medicaid program. If any state did opt out, Congress simply assumed that no state would or could. I think this at least suggests for the future that the real question is going to be whether Congress understood there to be a choice, regardless of how easy or difficult that choice might be. The amount at issue will clearly be a major consideration, but not inherently determinative. As the Chief Justice noted, the size of the new financial burden imposed on a state is irrelevant in analyzing whether the state has been coerced into accepting that burden. Your money or your life is a coercive proposition, whether you have a single dollar in your pocket or 500. Obviously, people are already thinking creatively Professor Jonathan Adler, I think the same day NFIB came down, suggested that the Clean Air Act, where one of the sanctions EPA can impose on states for failing to meet federal clean air requirements is the loss of highway, federal highway funds, may now be vulnerable. The amounts at issue here are not as much as Medicaid, but most state highway budgets are very much dependent on federal funds. There are, of course, differences between the two statutory schemes, and I can certainly see, I certainly do not anticipate that the court is going to strike down the Clean Air Act. Indeed, to the extent the court was able to transform the ACA's mandate into a tax re-cutting, the Air Act should be child's play. But certainly, I think that challenges along those lines are very likely to be seen. Clearly, we don't know where this will lead in the future, and I think what we're really going to see, I hope, is that cooperative federalism will actually start meaning cooperative federalism, and that this case has put a shot across Congress's bows so that it gives states who are the recipients of this type of federal largesse in the future the opportunity to challenge the conditions and perhaps to prevail. And so we'll see what happens in the future.
I have the unenviable task of disagreeing, because I really, really wish that I could agree wholeheartedly with the optimistic view of this case. I mean, look, let's put it in 20-year context. Ever since the Lopez decision and the Commerce Clause revolution, which revived the notion that the Constitution has enforceable limits on the power under the Commerce Clause, we've been recognizing that it was meaningless if we didn't find similar limits on the spending clause. And I think the limits are there to be had. We've had this conversation in this convention several times over the past few years. And as Lee pointed out, this is the first time ever that something was found to be unconstitutionally coercive and therefore a violation of the spending clause. So why am I not jumping for joy? I mean, you know, this is kind of one of my issues. I've been fighting for a long time. And Lee, I think, pointed out a couple of things. One, I think it's very likely this is a one-off case. It's a new program. And even that, the Chief Justice's reasoning, I think, is fairly weak. Justice Ginsburg really demolishes him on that. Now, I think there's a stronger case to be made, but I think the precedential value of this going forward is going to turn on the weakness of the Chief's reasoning on that. It is one-off because of the size of the Medicaid funding that's at issue. All existing Medicaid funding, 20% or more of existing state budgets. There is no other program in existence and no other program given our current financial situation that one can conceive of that will rise to that level. And it will be relatively easy for any court to say that anything less than that is valid, but particularly when you look at some of the Ginsburg lines about, well, the prior Medicaid expansion, you know, added millions to the rolls and what have you. The threat, I think, was not there. Other reasons why I'm not jumping for joy. This court unanimously reaffirmed the disastrous holding of South Dakota versus Dole. But every one of the decisions, no one takes issue with it at all. And in fact, the one who has some hint of suspicion of the holding in South Dakota versus Dole is Ginsburg, not anybody else in the case. I think that's a disaster. That case is wrong, and we ought to be challenging it every chance. It's now not possible to do so. In prior spending cases, we at least had such a possibility. The Chief Justice doesn't even address the other coercion issue that really underlies this thing, what I'll call the Richard Epstein bargaining with the state is always coercion issue, all right? Doesn't even address it. I mean, he implies that that's not a problem. Justice Ginsburg double downs on that point. She elevates to effective holding the concurring opinion from Justice Kennedy in the term limits decision on this issue, that taxing citizens in one state to pay for programs in other states is perfectly fine. That dicta is now tantamount to a holding this. The joint dissent doesn't disagree with that. In fact, they embrace that point, at least up to the level where we have the ACA funding level. And then in a footnote, they suggest that education funding, all of it, might not be enough to qualify here. And, you know, and let me just, you know, kind of point out what we're talking about. The last time the Supreme Court had struck down something on spending clause grounds, United States versus Butler, here's what they said about that issue. There is an obvious difference between a statute stating the conditions upon which money shall be expended and one effective only upon assumption of a contractual obligation to submit to a regulation which otherwise could not be enforced. If in lieu of compulsory regulation of subjects within the state's reserved jurisdiction, which is prohibited, the Congress could evoke the taxing and spending power as a means to accomplish some other end, the spending power would become the instrument for total subversion of the government powers reserved to the individual states. None of that is revived here. If anything, the lid on that is nailed conclusively shut. The Chief's opinion reaffirms political process federalism and expands it to now the commandeering context in a way that it had never applied before. South New York versus United States specifically rejected political process federalism in the context of commandeering of states. Political process federalism is another way of saying the courts aren't going to enforce the enumerated limits on federal power. The only thing that enforces the political process. Chief Justice is very glib on this. It is not our job to protect the people from the consequences of their political choices. Well, yes, it is your job. If the consequences of the political choices are something that exceeds the constitutional authority that Congress has under the Constitution, the court fully embraces Butler's ratification of Hamilton's view of the spending clause rather than Madison's. That's reaffirmed unanimously. Worse, it's shorn of the actual holding in Butler, which says you can't use spending to accomplish ends not granted. If we had taken the Butler holding, after just finding that this is not within the ends granted under the Commerce Clause, I would say you can't use the spending power to accomplish that end which is not granted. And yet unanimously the court accepts the Hamiltonian view of the spending power without that huge caveat in Butler. Again, nail in the coffin of any prospect of finding real limits on the spending power. The dissent, you know, as much as I like the dissent on the Commerce Clause and other stuff, ratifies this. Now, there's some hint in the dissent that maybe we're going to find some limits. They cite Justice Kennedy's dissenting opinion in the Monroe County case and Justice O'Connor's dissenting opinion in Dole. But then when they get to the litany of enforceable limits on spending power, those Dole limits, they don't even cite the General Welfare Clause as a limit. They just kind of forget about that. All right. You know, the notion that's just a non-justiciable political question has now kind of been given the sanction of the unanimous court here. I think that's devastating. Look, the bottom line, the direct tax clause, the proportionality requirement, that's in the Constitution was designed to work in tandem with the General Welfare Clause. Previously, the federal government was using its taxing powers to transfer wealth from one region to another or from one group of citizens to another. That's what those clauses were designed to prohibit. And I can do that just as effectively if I can tax one region to the benefit of the other, which I now authorize here, and I can do it if I can tax everybody but only spend the money in one region rather than the other. Those clauses were worked in tandem to present that kind of transfer of wealth. The possibility of reviving that understanding of the spending clause to provide real structural limits on what a national government can do, I think after this decision is just utterly gone. Maybe I'm naive to think there was some thread of hope before, but I don't think so anymore. Thanks.
Okay, well, despite Professor Eastman's enthusiastic presentation there, I want to start off with the observation that no one in the United States gives a fig about federalism. You know, you can tell this if you look at the political discourse over the last 40 or 50 years. So in the 1960s, we had a very liberal Congress, and it was enacting national legislation very aggressively to protect the environment, consumer rights, and imposing a lot of limits on business. And at that time, there was a lot of talk among conservatives about states' rights. So when you got a conservative Congress after the Contract with America, 1994, you might think, well, okay, so Congress is going to now cut back on federal power. Well, of course it didn't. What it did is enact its own national legislation in areas that it cared about on policy grounds. So they started nationalizing state criminal law. There was a arson prevention, Church Arson Prevention Act. They started nationalizing state tort law with the and state securities law with the Class Action Fairness Act. There was a transformation of the welfare laws, but it didn't change the role of the federal government. The federal government was still supervising through this cooperative process, still supervising the states. It was just, in certain ways, more aggressively under TANF than under AFDC. Then you had a conservative president elected in 2000, and so what happened is the national government, and at that point, of course, the national government is to the right of a lot of the states. So what happens, the national government acts to impose federal power against liberal state initiatives like assisted suicide, like medical marijuana, like global warming, and all of a sudden all the liberals are starting to talk about states' rights, how wonderful states' rights are. And you know, you see this, the entirely instrumental use of federalism. But that doesn't mean that federalism isn't important. Federalism is one of the most important instrumentalities of governance in the world. And what it does is enable countries that have very significant religious or linguistic or racial divisions that are geographically located to remain together as unified polities. So in Spain, the ability to grant, if they're going to have democracy, to grant federal rights to Catalonia or the Basque Country. In Belgium, the ability to create a federal system so that they can keep the country together despite the conflict between the Dutch and the French. In Canada, would have broken apart probably had they not been able to move to a highly federal system that gave partial autonomy to Quebec. Other countries like Nigeria rely on federalism in order to remain together as unified regimes. That's what federalism is used for. It's used for those kinds of very serious divisions and in order to keep a nation from breaking apart on the basis of those fault lines. Now, to talk about federalism in the United States is in a way to deny one of the greatest glories of our country. And that is that we've taken a incredibly diverse nation with no majority anymore and, you know, just people from all over the world and forged a truly strong, robust national identity. I mean, look, we don't even have a name for our country. We use a description. We don't have a name for ourselves. We use the name of a continent. That we got the notion of a nation from Western Europe, as we got all our political ideas, and there it represents an ethnicity, the French, the Spanish. And where they didn't have unified ethnicities, like the Balkans, they had real trouble with nationalism. As Winston Churchill said, the Balkans have produced more history than they can consume. And the reason for that was their inability to make nationalism work in a polyethnic situation. But we have made it work. And we have created an incredibly strong national identity for ourselves. When Hitler declared war on the United States, he knew he couldn't bomb the United States, he couldn't reach it, and he knew we were a major industrial power. He didn't think we could fight. What he said was, they're too ethnically diverse. They won't be able to fight. Well, we proved him wrong. And why would we want to mess around with federalism? I mean, that's playing with fire, man, right? Why would we? Do we want to become Belgium? Do we want to become Canada? Or do we want to treasure this ability to have forged this marvelous national unity? Now, of course, we have political divisions in this country, but they're not geographic, and they're not the kind that would yield a federalist solution. If you look, for example, at the map of the United States, the electoral map for the last election, last several elections, it looks a little bit regional if you look at the state level with these large patches of red and blue. But if you go down one level, if you look at a county by county map, every state looks the same. It's a red ocean with blue islands. You know, at the far right extreme of the continuum, you have a couple of states where there aren't any blue islands, or only one, like Idaho or Utah. If you go to the other extreme, at the extreme left side, the ocean, particularly little states like Vermont and Rhode Island, the ocean, to the extent there is one, is sort of blue. But basically, every state is the same. I think Paul Ryan was absolutely right in his recent interview when he said, the vote that went against us was the urban vote. That's the distinction, and it's a national distinction. It doesn't break down in regional or state-based ways that would yield federalist solutions. So, obviously, though, the ACA case was a very controversial case, and people really cared about it. So what was the case about? It wasn't about federalism. Federalism is just being used to get the case into court and to provide a kind of rhetorical flourish. What the case really is a kind of a perfect storm about some of the most truly controversial issues in our society. So there are basically three. One is providing benefits and services for working people is not particularly controversial in the United States now. Social Security is not particularly controversial. Mortgage support, it's true that there was a fiscal problem and the companies and the agencies collapsed, but the idea of providing mortgage support to working people who had access to the private market, that's not particularly controversial. And Medicare wasn't controversial. What is controversial is providing support for people who don't work. So what you have instead, instead of Social Security, you have TANF. That's very controversial. Food stamps are controversial. Public housing is controversial. And Medicaid is controversial. That's what the case is about, of course, primarily, is that we still have deep divisions in the society about the amount of aid that we want to give to people independent of of supporting them as workers. And the second thing that makes it even more intense is that we've always created a kind of division between these two. And what the ACA does is lump them together. That's when people said, get the government out of my Medicare, it wasn't just something silly. They meant Medicare, even though it's a government program, is something I've earned. And they were making that distinction between Medicare and Medicaid. Combining them together and making them a universal program is political dynamite in many ways, because it's a very controversial issue. And the third thing that's controversial is that this is one step along the lines to something that I think is going to dominate the Supreme Court and constitutional law for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, and that is minimum basic rights for people. We've already marched a fair way down that road. The notion is positive rights to minimum subsistence, to housing, to education, and to healthcare. Now, Brown against Board already recognizes that for education. We already have social programs that move in a good way down that line in other areas. Now, we've created something that is a right, in effect, to healthcare. Now, at this point, it's a statutory right, but statutory rights are the harbingers of constitutional rights for several reasons. One is that they represent a norm as well as positive law. And the second is it's much easier for the Supreme Court to declare a constitutional right once most of the work has been done in a statutory program. To declare a constitutional right to health care before the ACA would have been impossible, because it would have created a situation that the courts couldn't possibly manage. To clean up the edges of it after the ACA becomes a real possibility, and that, I think, is going to be the dominant issue for the court to confront as time goes forward. And in many, many other constitutional regimes, they've already debated this, or in fact, in some, recognized it. So that becomes the issue. And that's, I think, one of the things that's generating the intensity of the constitutional debate about this case. Now, one final point about the spending clause in particular. I think in this context, the decision makes sense in a way that you can't make sense of it doctrinally. I think doctrinally, it's just a mess, as I think both previous speakers have sort of suggested. But here's the way it works, it seems to me, in the sort of non-federalist social context, which is Justice Roberts, representing the swing vote here, did not want to put the court in the position of striking down such a major piece of legislation that's represented the initiative of one of the parties over 20 years, if not more, and was implemented as a result of a national election. But what he does is allow the principle of gradualism back in by essentially giving the states the opportunity to opt out of one of the very controversial aspects of this, which is the extension of Medicaid. So now this, some states will be able, responding to the range of political opinion in the country, some states will be able to say, no, we don't want to participate in this program. Now, that's not going to last a very long time. Over the course of the next decade, I have a feeling they're all going to join up. But this gives them a chance to respond to particular constituencies and do it on a more gradual basis. And I think that's the meaning of this. So I agree. I think I agree with Professor Eastman. I think it's a one-off decision, and it's not a doctrinal declaration. It's specific to this program, and it's a way to make this program palatable.
Good afternoon. Thank you to the Federalist Society for letting me speak, and thank you, Judge Smith, for reading my whole firm bio and putting out that nice advertisement. I'd just like to make four points here, some of them congruent, some of them a little tangential from what was here before. I take it all of you are familiar with this case. I take it probably most of you have read this case. But there are a number of myths about the case, starting with the title of this panel. The future of the spending clause. I can tell you exactly what the future of the spending clause is. It's the same as the past of the spending clause, and that's because there is no such thing as the spending clause. There is a taxation clause that says you can lay taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the general welfare and the common defense of the United States. Now, why is that distinction important? As a lot of us have remarked, many of the most important aspects of the United States Constitution, from the right to travel, the incident of citizenship, to the right to vote, very important incidents of citizenship, to the power of the eminent domain, its power to pass criminal laws in pursuance of the commerce power, are implied. They're implied by limitations on those powers, but they're not stated in direct terms. So the first thing we have to understand is that the spending power, like these very other important aspects of the constitutional structure, it's implied. And what that means is the future of the spending power, which does exist in the federal government, unlike the spending clause, which does not exist in the federal constitution, will be played out according to structural principles. The second thing I think is very important, particularly for a Federalist Society audience, is to try to grapple with the question of how much constitutional law is prudential, as Professor Rubin just suggested, and how much of it is logical. And here I am, a dissenter, I think, from the consensus here at the Federalist Society. Karen Hardin and I talked on the eve of the decision after the argument. She said, Rob, do you think Chief Justice Roberts is going to be swayed at all by media or public pressure? I said no. And I continue to believe that today for the very important reason that I was not surprised at all about the holding on the other part of the taxation clause, namely the fact that the individual mandate could be upheld as a tax. And just because I don't think this audience hears the other side enough, let me run through the compelling points that I think are implicit in the decision and the basis for that. The first one is just the test that was put forward by the litigants, particularly the states and not the NFIB, for the distinction between a tax and a non-tax. It committed the fallacy of the excluded middle or the false dilemma. It said essentially, and this was the CNF fabricators case, there's two things. There's punishment for an unlawful act on the one hand, or on the other hand, there's an exaction for support of the government. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, it's the excluded middle of the so-called Pigouvian tax that we see both in economic theory and in the real world, the cigarette tax. Let's assume that we tax cigarettes to the point where we're actually getting less revenue than we would get if we had a more modest cigarette tax. But we're doing that because of externalities. We say people who smoke impose a cost on the system. Now, that is a tax. That's within the taxing power. And there's nothing on the fact that it's not a penalty for an unlawful act. But it's also not an exaction for the support of the government. The point here is it's not that it's been calibrated to maximize revenue. It's been calibrated to optimize behavior. And the test that was put forward by the states excluded that. It created a false dilemma, the problem of the excluded middle. The second problem that they faced was that they didn't, I think, pay enough attention to the last great healthcare case. And this was the so-called Hillary Care case, if anybody of you remember before Obamacare. This was, of course, the Clinton case in the D.C. Circuit, where a conservative majority of Judge Williams and Judge Silberman actually construed a federal statute, the Federal Advisory Committee Act, according to constitutional avoidance principles, and actually changed the substance of that. So the Advisory Committee Act did not reach the First Lady, Hillary Clinton, who was commonly acknowledged to be the driving force behind health care. In dissent, the great James Buckley said, no, you can't do that. It's unconstitutional to apply that act, but you're going too far. You are rewriting that statute. And what a lot of you will have heard about the Affordable Care Act decision is something similar happened in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, that he, quote, rewrote the mandate. Now, that's not what happened. And how do we know that's not what happened? For two reasons. When you rewrite a statute, you have to do one of two things. You have to change its applicable scope or its applicable effect within the scope. And if you go back to how the statute operated in terms of its scope beforehand, unlike the Hillary Care case in the Federal Advisory Committee Act, there was no change in scope and there was no change in effect within that scope. And then the third problem that made it problematic not to uphold it or considering upholding it as a tax was the fact that the states on page 55 of their brief, I believe, specifically said that they disavowed the disavowal of the taxing power. They said that because of the form of the statute, you know, the differentiation between the penalty in subsection B and the mandate in subsection A and the differential exclusions in subsections D and E, we're not saying that Congress disavowed the taxing power. Well, once you've disavowed the disavowal, what's left of your argument? It does the unthinkable, doesn't it? It, quote unquote, exalts form over substance by saying that this has to be a mandate because there's two provisions, A and B, and two sets of exclusions, D and E. So, as I said before the argument, and as I'm saying now, it does not surprise me at all that they considered this mandate as a tax and that it was upheld on that basis. Now, let me say that I think it is an unconstitutional tax. And that's where I agree with John Eastman. And that is where the prudential part of this decision came in, is as the joint dissent pointed out, there was very imperfect briefing in this case. Two paragraphs of briefing in some of the principal briefs. I think, what was it, John, 19 lines in the government's brief. And I think that the prudential decision came down to an end of the term decision with imperfect briefing. Do you have supplemental briefing like the joint dissenters insisted, or do you go forward? Now, why do I say all that as background? I think that nicely encapsulates on the mandate side the dynamics that will play out on the spending clause side. And I think it's very difficult to say how those dynamics will play out on the spending clause side, because you have the same interplay of logic and principle and prudence that will play out on that side? And what are some of the things that will go that will determine that going forward? I think this was a sea change. I think it was a sea change, not only for the reason that Lee Casey said, that it is the first case ever to hold a federal spending statute unconstitutional in decades or many years, depending on what you think about Butler or how you categorize that. I think that's huge. Just having that case on the books is huge. I think it's also very important for the structural reasons that we talked about before. As the opinion opens, what are the cases that are first cited? Haldeman. These spending statutes are the nature of the contract. Even more important, New York versus United States and Prince. The problem here is commandeering. The problem here is political accountability. This isn't federalism just for the states, this is federalism for the citizens. The citizens need to know who's doing a good job and who's not doing a good job. I've got Mike Grieve's excellent book there that I encourage you all to read, The Upside Down Constitution. I used that as a reference book, and I looked up a day or so ago when that idea entered our political discourse. And the cases that John has been fighting for so long from the 1920s, like Frothingham v. Mellon, Massachusetts v. Mellon, are litigated on the same issues, but using a very different vocabulary. They didn't have the idea of commandeering. They didn't have the idea of political accountability. They didn't have the idea that Professor Grieve stresses of exclusivity and directness leads to transparency, leads to accountability. So the ideas in this case, putting aside the prudential reasons that we've talked about, they are a sea change. And Professor Grieve says that the idea of political accountability and transparency only dates back to the past 25 years or so to Chief Justice, Justice O'Connor's dissent in FERC versus Mississippi in 1982. But to have that idea of spending clause limitations for purposes of Republican government, if you like me and like that side of language, or if you're more economically oriented, based on public choice theory, the need to prevent intergroup capture, et cetera. That is a whole nother line of discourse that can come into a clause like we've seen in many other clauses and then animate the development of that clause. Some of us were talking last night about the free exercise clause and the idea that every conscience cannot be a law unto itself, like in the Smith case. The idea of true private choice in the school vouchers case, which was not there before Zelman. Or even the idea of, you know, content-based versus viewpoint-based regulation under the free speech clause. At the time of Massachusetts versus Mellon in the 1920s, all these clauses were on the books. But what you didn't have was the doctrine that was making the distinctions that could compel these forward. And the final example I'll leave you with, that I think proves the point best of all, is the case that was mentioned before, the Lopez case. What was unique about the Lopez case? Why has the Lopez case had some legs, so we're still talking about it 15 years later? The facts of the case were fairly mundane and not very important, carrying a gun to school. But what it did was it introduced two new ideas into the Commerce Clause jurisprudence that weren't there before. The idea that you can't pile inference upon inference, so there's no stopping point, so that everything becomes within the power of the national government. I think that was implicit before, but it was much better stated. And then this critical distinction that was made first in Lopez and then solidified in the Affordable Care Act case of the difference between economic activity and non-economic activity, and now what we know is non-economic non-activity. The idea that the Commerce Clause can only regulate economic activity is a product of an insight into the doctrine that you really have a hard time finding becoming what I call operational before the Lopez case and this line of cases. So I will tell you, I don't know whether the taxation clause is going to develop in this direction. I do know that prudential reasoning is going to play an important part, as it did in the decision not to take supplemental briefing in this case. The fact that, you know, the federal government has a lot of these programs on the books, in part because they were non-justiciable for so years, will play a big part. But there are new openings for new doctrines, and there are doctrines that have actually been borrowed for other areas of constitutional law, and they may have legs going forward under this clause. Thank you.
Unlike most lawyers arguing to federal courts of appeals, these four presenters have all stayed well within their time limits, for which I thank them. So they've earned some good rebuttal time, and if any of you would like to add anything to your remarks or respond to anything that one of the other panelists has said, we have some time for that, and I think we'll have some good time for questions as well. So we'll go in the same order. Lee Casey, do you have anything else? You can just stay there, but I've been asked to tell you to pull the microphones up close because they don't project very well.
Great. Is it?
It's probably on.
It's probably on? Okay. Very good. Just a couple things. John, I hope you're wrong.
I hope I am too.
Professor Rubin, I think perhaps gave a little bit short shrift to the nature of our federalism, in addition to, at least originally, allowing different portions of the country to get on a little better. There's also the little matter of controlling state power by dispersing it, and I think that is very much a part of our federalism, and that is not, of course, a part of the federalism that we see and have seen in Europe. In terms of what the Obamacare case was about, I can certainly say that in all of the various discussions, the many discussions that there were during that litigation, I certainly never heard anyone suggest that the purpose was because we wanted to avoid providing health care to people who don't work. The purpose of the litigation was because both NFIB and Karen, I think, is here, and the states first believed that the law exceeded Congress's power, and of course, on the Medicaid portion, the states were very, very concerned about the new burdens that were being imposed on them, and it was not because they didn't want to pay for people who weren't working. It was because they felt that they could not pay. Ultimately, because I'm not sure anyone ever has taken very seriously Congress's assurances that at least past 2020 that it will continue to foot the bill, and I'm not sure it would have been responsible, frankly, for the states to have assumed that, since we know that Congress can indeed change its mind. With respect to Robert's thoughts, I obviously, you know, it may well be that the case could have been briefed better. I don't think it would have made any difference. I think the chief did what he did to avoid striking down this law. I think with respect to the tax argument, you know, one thing that he did not really grapple with, and I think is very important, is that this is not an instance where Congress left any doubt about what power it was exercising. This is indeed the precedent he cites, the single precedent, in his opinion, to support the proposition that the court can indeed, isn't bound by what Congress calls a particular law in trying to uphold it. Involved an instance where Congress had not said, made clear in any way, shape, or form. In this case, Congress enacted as part of the law a page and a half of findings apropos to the Commerce Clause in the statute. I mean, for those who don't much like legislative history, obviously the legislative history such as it was and the politics surrounding the bill made very clear that Congress was not choosing to exercise its taxing power. But that was in the legislation too, and I think the court ignored that, or rather I think the chief ignored that, and gave us a fairly an opinion that indeed in the future is going to be hard to interpret and hard to apply.
Yeah, let me, after listening to Ed Rubin's comments, I have to confess error. I was wrong. I thought I had thought of all the reasons that this decision was bad. I had not thought of the fact that it was going to be a precursor to a positive constitutional right to health care. So let me add that to the list. something else he said I fully agree with, and this goes to the Epstein any bargaining with the state is coercion point that I think is the real coercion here, and that the chief's opinion just completely acts as if there's no problem. Every single state within 5 years, I'm not even going to give them 10, I think within 5 years they will all be part of this, because the choice that they're now left with is to have all the taxpayers from their state paying for this $100 billion program, and either we get 90% of it back or we get none of it back. That's no choice. All right, that is equally, it may be a six shooter instead of a bazooka. It's equally a gun to the head of the states. It's an equal violation. But you don't get there unless you recognize the limits that the founders recognized in the general welfare clause, which means it had to be for the general or national interest, not playing one region off another. None of that seems to me remain possible. My good friend Rob Gassaway, I hope he's right as well, and I hope Lee's right, and I hope I'm dead wrong about this stuff. I hope this is a sea change, but let me take up the political accountability and transparency point with respect to Medicaid. Because if that's what we were after, and if that represented the sea change here, here's how I would have liked to have seen the political accountability and transparency issue articulated in the "this is a valid exercise of the taxing power" part of the opinion. I would have said Congress can't do this under the Commerce Clause. We think they can under the taxing clause, and for the reasons I've articulated earlier, I don't think that's even true, but let's assume that is true. But they didn't do so here. There's a reason the direct tax clause, the tax clause says that all taxes have to originate in the House of Representatives. This didn't. It's because of political accountability. So you want to do that with political accountability, say it's a tax, pass the bill that was introduced in the House that failed, that tried to do this as a tax, take the political heat for it. And until you do that, we're not going to give you the political cover by pretending that it's a tax. Because how have we seen that political accountability work out? The very people that hid what they were doing, claiming it was a tax on the front end, continue to insist that it wasn't a tax on the back end. Where do you get political accountability out of that? And I just don't see how we're going to get any more political accountability and transparency on the Medicaid side either. Maybe I'm wrong about that, and again, I hope I am, but I'm not optimistic that the seeds of this opinion are going to yield such fruit.
Professor Rubin?
Yeah, well, I wasn't actually trying to persuade this audience with my positive rights point. I was just making an observation that I think that's going to be on the agenda. Just a couple of subsidiary points. Federalism doesn't protect liberty. France has a lot of liberty. The Soviet Union, which was a federal regime, didn't. What protects liberty is a commitment to liberty and democratic systems of government by which that commitment can be instantiated, and that can be done either in a national regime or in a federal regime. It's true that if you create independent power centers, they can fight against the central government, but depends what they're fighting for. Prior to the Civil War, they were fighting for slavery. It depends on what the dynamic is, not on what the structure is, because the structure will only instantiate the beliefs that people have. The other thing I'd point out is the accountability point has, and Rob mentioned it too, has become very popular as a defense of federalism. You know, if you try to trace it out, it depends on a series of assumptions about what the voters are attuned to and what they're aware of. Do they really know where the program is coming from? Is that what their vote is based on? Is that what politicians are campaigning on? I mean, just listen to them. That's not it. I mean, if their state is compelled to institute a program and they don't like the program, it's completely within the power of the politician to say, I don't like this program. We were enforced to do it by the federal government. Then people can vote for that person. I mean, the notion that people have a kind of refined ability to distinguish between what the state is compelled to do and what the state has chosen to do, I think is just a misunderstanding of the level at which the political process works and the way in which politicians stake out positions and create an identity for themselves as being on one side or other of the political spectrum.
Briefly, I guess, just 2 points. On the taxation clause spending side, remember that my point about accountability started in 1982 with FERC versus Mississippi. This decision, the first one operationalizing that under this clause, is 30 years later. So when we're talking about developments in constitutional law, we're really talking about over a generation. And I do think that over generations, the drivers of constitutional law are better understandings of constitutional law and external circumstances. I do think that one of the main benefits of federalism or a properly constructed federalism is better political accountability, better democracy. And I do think another driver of policy over the next 30 years will be fiscal constraint. I don't think that fiscal expansion can happen over the next 30 years as it has over the past 30 years. And I think that one of the drivers of fiscal expansion over the past 30 years have been the leveraging effect that Professor Eastman, my good friend, says is going to make every state sign up, not within 10 years, then within 5 years. And that same dynamic, which makes them sign up, is going to put a strain on state and federal finances. And at some point, there's going to have to be a rethinking about how we avoid that strain. So I think that's going to be one dynamic. The other dimension of political accountability that John discussed was just, well, the fact that the Congress or the President or the executive avoided accountability by, as has been pointed out, crafting this in a way that it looked like a mandate, although it operated as a tax, justifying it under the Commerce Clause with findings, but not under the Taxing Clause, and then carefully limiting it so it operated just like a tax, with two provisions that, as I say, don't exist in nature. One, the idea that the penalty has to be limited to the amount of health care. So that makes it look like a tax. Think of a parking violation or a tow away, where the amount of the payment that you have to pay is either limited to how much the tow truck cost, or it's $1 million or something like this. One looks very much like a penalty. One looks more like it's a user fee for parking in the parking place or a tax. They carefully limited that so that operation wouldn't happen. The other provision that doesn't exist in nature or very often in the Internal Revenue Code is this idea that you can't have an additional penalty for not paying the first payment that you have to pay. If I don't pay my income taxes this year, it's not just that I'll have to get around and pay the same amount next year. I'll have interest and penalties because obviously it's very little incentive to comply with the law. And one of the design features that we saw very early on was built into this statute precisely to make it more operational in as a tax, I think, was this feature that you couldn't ever have the liability beyond your primary mandate amount. So while there is evidence in the statute of sort of conscious design to have it upheld under the commerce power, and I think that's the whole reason the Chief Justice was right in addressing the commerce power and evaluating it before he got to the taxing power, there's also a lot of evidence that they knew from the start that they were constructing this to operate like a tax. And one of the great parlor games that I have with my friends is, at what point in this process did the defenders of the Affordable Care Act legislation reach the conclusion that some of them were saying in private, that namely it was more likely to be upheld as a tax than as an exercise of the commerce power? Clearly, they would have preferred that it be upheld under the commerce power, because unless the holding is expanded, you do have a taxing power, but you have a taxing power that's limited in its enforcement to sort of the amount of the harm or the amount of the benefit, and can't be included by the ordinary penalties that would be used in an enforcement regime.
All right, we have time for questions. If anyone has any, we have three microphones, and I'll start with the middle microphone, and then I'll alternate between among the three. Let me just say, we want to be pretty strict that these are real questions and not speeches or arguments, because the purpose is to engage in a conversation with the panelists and not independently to be a panelist yourself. So with that understanding, we'll start with the middle microphone. Yes, sir.
Kai Alberg from Port Angeles, Washington. Seems to be a fair summary that from most of the panelists that the individual mandate as such was not upheld, but that it was said it's okay to impose a tax as long as the tax is not punitive or confiscatory. And some panelists have said, well, since the tax is less than what the insurance would have been, that makes it okay under that test. My question to the panel is, can you read from this decision where this might be taken in the future? Could Congress impose a mandate that everybody has to buy a Chevy Volt or have a dwelling of at least two bedrooms to support the struggling housing market, or otherwise pay a tax for being underhoused or undertransported? And if so, would the limit of the tax be the value of an apartment or of a car? Or what other limit, if any, is discernible from this decision is okay as not excessive or confiscatory?
Anybody?
Let me start by saying, since I focus on the Medicaid piece, I don't think it's a valid tax either. I think it's a direct tax, and I think it's not apportioned according to population, and I think that makes it unconstitutional. And I think it's a ridiculous circularity in the Chief's argument, where he says direct taxes have to be apportioned according to population. This one isn't, therefore it must not be a direct tax. So I don't accept the premise, but since the Chief did, I don't see what the limiting principle here is. If I want to, in the examples you give, if I want to tax you for not having energy efficient windows or energy efficient cars or eating the wrong kind of food because it's going to incur costs that we'll share, across the board on the healthcare system, Congress has the full power to do that. And there's nothing in any of these opinions that limit the taxing power and what its purpose can be in the way that Butler used to do. And I think that's devastatingly bad. And you remember in Justice Kagan's confirmation hearing, she was asked that question, could I force you to eat broccoli? Well, let's change it a little bit. Can I impose a tax on you if you don't eat broccoli? Right? She couldn't even find that was not within the commerce power. All she said was, that would be pretty stupid. Said, I'm not asking you that. Is that, do we have the constitutional authority to do that? And she would not say no.
Anybody else have a...
Let me make one comment on that. I think one of the key questions going forward, above all else, is the extent to which the court will treat as precedential its holding and reasoning with respect to this argument about an unapportioned direct tax. I think that the joint dissent was absolutely correct on this, if a little bit overly colorful, in saying that it was decided on, quote, fly-by-night briefing. I think 90% of the people in the room know that less stare decisis effect is given to constitutional rulings than to statutory rulings. The unapportioned direct tax argument is purely constitutional. We've all seen the principle in jurisdictional rulings that quote unquote drive-by jurisdictional rulings are not precedent at all. This wasn't a drive-by ruling, it was just a woefully underbriefed ruling. As the joint dissent said, in unusually colorful language and unusually in two places, I defy anybody in this room to find another Supreme Court opinion where four justices used that kind of strong language multiple times in an opinion, as opposed to saying, I would prefer not to reach this or something like that. So I think that there's a political question I won't opine on as to whether or not using the taxing power would be attractive. My question is, when that case comes up, if it ever does, what level of deference would the court give to this precedent in the face of a 50-page brief that laid out the whole history of the unapportioned direct tax argument? And I tell you, the irony of that argument, just to go on here, is the one thing that NFIB stands for is they don't like death taxes. I've heard Dan Danner, the head of the NFIB, say something against quote-unquote death taxes, inheritance taxes, state taxes, multiple occasions. The other irony is that in the lower courts, when NFIB and the other litigants were trying to draw the line between affirmative act and failure to act, they'd get the type of question that says, well, what's your best case for that under the Commerce Clause? What's your case that says that it's the distinction? And to tie it all together, the irony is that distinction between action and inaction that prevailed under the Commerce Clause, that had never been litigated, had never been in a precedent under the Commerce Clause, exists under the direct taxation precedents. And they just didn't have time to pull it out. And it actually exists in the case that created the label that Dan always uses. It doesn't say death taxes, but it says death duties. And it says basically the activity inactivity distinction is the distinction between direct taxes or indirect taxes. Now, would the court, in a subsequent case of the type that you mentioned, dust off that distinction, take heart from having put so much emphasis on that under the Commerce Clause, take the other arguments that John has published about the direct taxation issue, get over the fact that the issue was decided on the merits, albeit with very imperfect briefing, and say we're going to take another look at that. And that is a question that I think will be very interesting to see the answer to.
All right, let's move to a question over here.
Ilya Soman, George Mason Law School. So I want to ask about an aspect of the spending clause decision that hasn't been much talked about here, and that in that decision, at least in the Chief Justice opinion, he emphasized that while he's saying that this degree of coerciveness that exists here is unconstitutional, he didn't say that only things that are as coercive as these grants were are unconstitutional. To the contrary, he said, well, we're not drawing a clear line between where persuasion ends and coercion begins. And that suggests, in turn, perhaps that there's room for movement in future cases to striking down things that are less coercive than this, but still coercive enough to be not merely inducements or incentives and the like. So this could, depending on who's on the court and what cases come down, could this not be a situation where this is the first step in a doctrinal evolution and not the end of the road?
I would agree with that. I think it is the first step in a doctrinal evolution. Obviously, where it's going is not clear. I don't think the rationale of the analysis that either the chief or the joint dissenters used was entirely linked or necessarily linked to the amount involved, although that was obviously very important. So that I think there is room for the argument to be raised in other cases. Again, as I mentioned earlier, whether we're going to see an actual doctrine that develops or whether the court will just know it when it sees it, that I don't know.
And Ilya, I hope you're right, but here's some cold water on that from the dissenting opinion. Sometimes you have to be careful about how strongly you state your case in dissent, because it comes back to bite you. I think Justice Scalia's point in Lee versus Weissman. He says, look, if we accept this proposition, the next thing you know, we're going to have to rule that the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional, right? And, you know, Steve Reinhardt took that very seriously. And I suspect he'll take this one very seriously as well. This is how we're distinguishing how this is a one-off case. This is so massive. It's all existing Medicaid funding. The states are far less reliant on federal funding for any other program. After Medicaid, the next biggest federal funding item is aid to support elementary and secondary education, which amounts to 12.8% and equals only 6.6% of all state budgets. I can't read that without implying that those things would meet the test under this statute, and that's in the dissenting opinion, which is, you know, generally with all the conservatives. So, this is what troubles me, that line that they said, we're not setting the innermost line in the way that previously we hadn't set the outermost line, but I don't know how much room there is to move when I'm saying the second biggest one looks like it's okay.
Well, at least we can be grateful they didn't announce a 12-prong test or something.
Exactly.
Okay. Question over here.
Jack, excuse me, Jack Park from Atlanta. Illinois has a substantial problem with the funding of its public pension system, and Governor Quinn has recently floated the notion of a federal bailout. Would it be a constitutional exercise of the spending power for Congress to bail out Illinois in these circumstances?
As an original matter or as currently interpreted? As an original matter, the answer to that is no. We had this issue. There was in the 1790s, there was a huge recession in New England, and they needed to bail out the cod fishery industry and the state obligations to the cod fishery industry. And on the floor of Congress, Madison said, we can't do that. It's unconstitutional. It's not in the general welfare. And that line held for 150 years. It hasn't held ever since.
Right,
and by the way, you've got to take, California's going to be in line ahead of you on that one.
Okay, I think we have one more question.
Hi, Matthew Schmidt with the Columbia Student Chapter. I have what I fear is an extremely narrow question for Mr. Gassaway. At the beginning of your remarks, you'd started with the insight that there is not a spending clause, but rather the spending power is simply an implied one from the general welfare clause. And I was just curious, I was hoping you might amplify for a moment what work you would hope that insight to do, because it seems an implied power could still be very capacious. I guess what I have in mind when I say that is a lot of the president's foreign affairs powers are implied, but we surely wouldn't say they're anything but capacious. And I wondered what work you meant that to do.
Absolutely. And the work that it has to do is it has to imply that the contours on that power are conceptual or principled rather than trying to figure out what the framers had in mind. And let me give you an example from the cases we were talking about. In the Frothingham case on the spending power, the claim in the 1920s was that it violated the Due Process Clause. And this is similar to the separation of powers claim, if you know the case of Plout versus Spendthrift Farms from the 1990s. Two claims in that case. Number one, it violated separation of powers for Congress basically to revivify a cause of action that had expired according to its original statute of limitations, or a due process claim on those who were on the receiving end of that revivification. Critically, Justice Scalia's opinion for the court did not take the due process route, but it took the separation of powers route. And what it did was it looked at the inherent nature of the legislative, executive, and judicial powers of the United States, asked what those differences are. It didn't make this point, but it could have, that the distinction between those was explicit in John Adams' Massachusetts Constitution at the time ours was adopted. It was preferred in our Constitution to leave those distinctions as matters of structure in the first section of each of those provisions. And so from that, you don't ask yourself, as you might if you had framed it as a due process question, what were the framers and ratifiers of the Due Process Clause thinking back in the 1860s, but you ask yourself, what are the structural principles of separation of powers in our system? Same thing here in federalism, if you conceptualize the spending power as an implied power resident in all governments, the work it does is it it takes you less out of what I would call the narrow originalist move mode and more in the broader originalist mode. And I don't want to imply by that that this means there's anything goes interpretation. The case that I'm citing for an exemplar of this sorts of reasoning is obviously Justice Scalia's decision in Plout versus Benfrith Arms in the separation of powers case. But what that suggests is the court, as spinning out spending clause doctrine, won't be asking so much what the limits on commandeering were expected to be, although that will be an important addition. But what is the purpose of our federal structure? I do think it promotes liberty, unlike Professor Rubin. I do think it promotes accountability and transparency when properly shaped. And I think that that becomes more a part of the discourse the more you look at it as an implied power together with all of the other clauses of the Constitution that affects it.
And let me just like to add Professor Rubin, go ahead, please.
One little point to that, which in agreement with what Rob was saying, which is that, you know, this is a late 18th century document. To make it work, it has to be read in terms of the fact that we've had, between the time that document was written and the current time, the largest qualitative change in government since the early Middle Ages, which is the advent of an administrative and regulatory state. And I think everyone is concerned about the fairness, the efficiency, the potential for oppression that that regulatory state creates, but at the same time, it's quite apparent that we can't do without it. And so the question is to think through the implications of the document in modern terms. They're not going to be there because it wasn't drafted with a modern state in mind. It couldn't be because that state didn't exist when it was written.
I think it plays out a little bit differently. And to pick up on Rob's point, if it's an implied power, you have the power to tax, and obviously you get to spend, but for the common defense and general welfare becomes much clearly a limitation on that power. I think in South Dakota versus Dole, they viewed it as the grant of power itself rather than as a limitation, and they've never explored, they've abdicated any effort to try and define welfare, and perhaps appropriately so, that's really a policy judgment, but they've also abdicated on defining what's general rather than local, which was Hamilton said, you know, he didn't accept Madison's view that the limitations were on the other grants of power. It's within the text itself, but he found that a limitation. It has to be national, not local. And it turns out when you play that out, there's not much difference between Madison and Hamilton because all of the other delegated powers were things that could only be done at the general or national level and couldn't be done individually by state. So you end up largely in the same place if you view it as a limitation. It has to be for general, and it's a judicially enforceable limitation if the court would get back in the game, and it would enforce the direct tax proportionality requirement and all of the structural reasons those things are there to prevent these kind of debilitating, war-inducing conflicts among the regions and among the states.
Thank you, and thanks for all the good questions. We thank our panelists for their fantastic presentations.